Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
This is a podcast while walking. I'm going to cover the next section of capacitors. Now, just to put you in the picture, I've slowly improved everything that's going along. I'm using a shotgun microphone, an interview microphone. And so that, fortunately, is picking up my voice and discriminating against the traffic and the sound and the wind, etc. It's sort of a bit uncomfortable to do. And what I've done is give my first talk on capacitors, where I sort of, sort of first thing that comes into your mind, you know, capacitor, what's the difference between a capacitor, a resistor and an inductor? They're all passive components. And if you've got a picture of electricity being electrons, you have resistors, and the capacitors are a bit befuddling. But if you actually think of electricity and wires carrying electric field as they do, you get another picture of capacitors, and they're basically respond to the applied voltage across them, and we'll just talk a little bit about them. So a resistor is a wire where the current through it creates heat, is converted to energy, it could be converted to light, anything like that, and or heat, and this is due to the Fermi electrons interacting with the crystal phonons. So I tried to explain that last time, and this is just an indicator that any real in-depth understanding of electronics, besides, I suppose, inductors are magnetic fields, and you have to actually think about magnetic fields, and that's indeed special relativity gets you into magnetic fields. Yeah, ultimately, you have to actually... You don't go too far before having to do some quantum mechanics. You can avoid doing quantum mechanics, all right, but then what you do is you basically teach people a whole set of ideas which leads them into a dead end. So I don't know, the analogy would be, say, navigating through the Blue Mountains. There's one main road that you go along, and if you go off that, you'll eventually hit a cliff. And so you'll just wind up in the suburb and not be able to do anything. Similarly, to say, if you are there's a train line through an area, there's a way to go which gets over the train line, and then other bridges which don't get you across. Sort of, it may appear a shortcut, but it gets you all caught up. And so essentially, the traditional discussion of electrons as a tiny little point particle, and electricity is the flow of these point particles, a bit like hundreds and thousands going down a tube, is something that's very conceivable, conceptually plausible. If you go into it, and what I will do is actually say, well, how do we know the electron's got a negative charge? How do we know it's this? And essentially, we can make people think they know things by suggestion, coercion, a form of sort of social grade hypnosis, and hopefully we'll get a little bit before that. Now, I thought a little bit about it, and I just want to describe what a capacitor is. I've said what it does. So it stores electrical energy. It's a little bit like a electrostatic battery. It's essentially it's two plates connected by two wires. One wire in a plate, a gap, and then another plate above it, another wire out. And if you arrange, if you remove electrons from one plate, the plate above it will see positive charges and electrons will flow into that. Now there's and it is true that the number of electrons in your top plate will increase, and in fact the top plate will increase in mass ever so lightly. So if your negatively charged plate will be a little bit heavier, and that's times the extra electrons times the mass. But it doesn't actually mean those electrons are point particles. They're still wave functions, and we'll have to get into that. And so essentially, what I want to do is talk you through the basic capacitance circuit. So if I've got two plates, and I connected up to a DC inverted commas dry cell battery. So a dry cell battery, if you drill a hole on it and shake it up and turn it down, it actually won't pour out as liquid. It's like it's a non-liquid battery, but it's actually a paste battery. So in your dry cell battery, on the negative electrode, the bottom electrode, there's a metal, and the metal is a great source of electrons, and as the metal gets converted into an ion, say zinc into a zinc ion, it ionizes, it produces electrons, and so electrons come out the bottom of the case, and in the inner side of the case, ions, positive ions flow, and it's one of these things that electrons can flow through a metal, but they can't flow through a liquid or another version of a liquid called a glass. So glass, it's not that glass isn't liquid, but liquid is a glass in terms of there's no entropy, glasses of high entropy, there's no a way that a particular wave function can actually propagate or grow to the size of the crystal. There's no crystal there. So metals are crystals, and the paste is a glass. Now, this is something I suppose we have to cover in physics, that although everyone knows gas, liquid, solid, the actual story of it is that it's crystal, glass, gas, and it's the crystal-glass transition or glass-gas transition, which signifies as a change in entropy, and the change in entropy is energy. And that's the way you go. Now, people learn and know that there's a change in energy if you go from liquid to solid, but they only know that because they've been indoctrinated that. Actually, when you really peel away, they say, well, I learned it on such a grade 4 at school, whatever it is, and the teacher marked me correct in 1 year. Then when I remembered it the next year, it was marked correct again, so therefore, if the teacher in the education system deems it correct, that's all I need to know. And what obviously happens is that if you say, well, look, what you're taught is inadequate, but the actual real story is about entropy, and you've got solid and liquid. So let's go back. Solid, liquid, and gas really should be crystal, glass, and gas to look at the entropy aspect. So you can actually have something quite solid, and it goes to a crystal transition from a glass, becomes vitrified, and as it does so, release heat energy to go into it. I was climbing up a hill. I wonder how the shotgun microphone takes this, and it's actually quite quiet around here. I just really hope the microphone picks up a bit better sound quality and doesn't, you don't hear me walking around, and it's actually quite still, and I've selected it to go up here. So why I'm stopping here is that your battery, your metal is corroding, releasing electrons. The electrons can't follow the ions in. They have to take a circuitous route. The ions can pass through a liquid. The liquid is a moist paste. So inside your battery is an electrolyte, and on the surface there, the electrons combine with hydrogen ions, and in your typical dry cell batteries, there's a chemical reaction, and hydrogen ions combine with the electrons which have gone through the circuit, and come out as hydrogen gas, and there's a small price to pay to remove the energy involved to remove the electrons from the metal, but the electrons fall into the hydrogen, and we'll talk about that in a little while. The actual let's put it a different way. The hydrogen ions fall into electrons. That's a better thing. The electron is much bigger, and the hydrogen ion falls into the center of it and produces a molecule. And that falling into the the electron, the proton falling into the center of the electron. And look, I'm not making this up. This is dinky die, full quantum physics. And you can learn something, you can learn it through years of schooling, or you can just spend 5 minutes looking at the Schrodinger wave equation and move on. It's sort of, I don't know quite how to describe it. It's sort of like a typical military situation where the intelligence is garbled, and then there's just clear analysis of what's going on, and you can move on. So the proton is falling into the electron, and that is sort of pretty much providing the electric field of your battery. And that electric field of your battery, or the pull of the battery, is typically 1.5 volts for hydrogen. For hydrogen being produced, you get other chemical batteries, and there's all different stories here. So a dry cell is irreversible because the hydrogen goes away, whereas your wet cell batteries, your lead acid batteries, are a different story, where the electron does fall in or fall into a set of atoms. Like, this is without joking, an electron will fall into a chlorine and form Cl minus with the release of energy, and that electron that's electrostatically pushing, and that will can provide an electric field, an electric push of electrons around a circuit. So what we do is we connect our two terminals up together, and the electrons, the terminals to the two plates of the capacitor, and electrons will flow from the flow from the bottom part of the battery to the bottom, the lower plate, and as it does so, it will push electrons in the top plate away, or repel, the electrons repel each other, and the top plate will become positively charged until the electric field builds up between the plates such that is equivalent to the electric balance to the electric field pulling the electrons into the hydrogen ions. Look, I'm sure people are just going to say, well, bloody hell, why has no one ever described it to me that way? Well, that is because, I'm just trying to think why people wouldn't describe, I know no one has described it to me that way. It's just, I suppose, look, if you've, I think a lot of people don't ask things because they're not asking questions as part of their social contract. So their social contract to be a student or a teacher is not to ask questions, not ask deeply. And in my case, my social, because I've been, I suppose, bullied at work, my social contract at work has been broken. No, I haven't thought, I've been bullied at work, I'm not going to think any differently. It's just that you then say, oh, well, you know, how does this happen? So this is how it happens. So essentially your electrons are falling in, your protons are falling into the electrons, pulling them up one way, or the electrons are being pulled away to the protons, or the positive charges left on the electrodes. Now, we have to really look into what we mean by positive charges. Okay, so there's not individually exposed atoms on the top plate, your top positive plate. So the voltage between your top and bottom plates, if it's 1.5 volts, will be 1.5 volts the opposite direction. So you'll create a battery and you'll create an opposing electrostatic battery, putting the opposite end. And if you disconnect it, the charge will remain on your battery. So you can charge up as many batteries as you like from your dry cell battery. So you can make a 1.5 volt battery, can actually charge these capacities, capacitors, which are electrostatic batteries. And those electrostatic batteries oppose your two batteries and the current stops flowing. So the current will, if you have an uncharged capacitor, your capacitor will suddenly charge and it will develop the voltage to your thing there. And what will happen is that your plates will have opposite charges, and opposite charges attract, and your plates will pull together. And the force has to be counteracted either by a material between the two plates, which gets compressed, or as a container, which supplies holding forces. It's like a house. There's the walls, which will lift the roof. The roof up, and if you can imagine mold growing on your roof, the roof will get a bit harder and heavier. Mold and moisture in the shower, so to speak, the mold will get a little bit heavier. Now, in the case that's due to electrostatic force, there'll be less electrons there, so it will be a little bit gravitational wise, a little bit lighter. So you'll get some forces there, and if you discharge your if you disconnect your capacitor from your battery and then connect your capacitor up to your lamp, the lamp will just glow a very, very tiny amount. Now, if you have a huge amount of charge, because we now have supercapacitors, this is quite a substantial amount of charge, and it's generally about 2.5 volts. You'll be able to see your lamp glow for, I don't know, I think you might get 30 seconds worth of glow out of one of these things. I can remember doing this with the biggest capacitors I could find, and this would be just a little blow. Now, I'm just going to tell you an example. Is if you can remember the old flash units, if your parents, you wouldn't have them, and they would go meee. Now, of course, this is high frequency to produce high voltage, and the high voltage is stored in capacitors, and the capacitors go to your xenon lamp, and your xenon lamp has a little ring in it next to the electrode. This is a ring which creates a little bit of a discharge, and then your capacitor discharges all at once. All the energy of your capacitor goes, because your xenon flashlight is very highly conductive. It's either, once the ions are produced, it flashes, and you have a xenon flash within a microsecond. You flash, and so you can actually get a stop action. So if you have someone bouncing a ball and you take a flash thing, it's the ball and everything is frozen in time, because there's what we perceive as time. Our eyes blur motion over time. This is far faster than our brain. The flash of the light comes into our head and we see it. It's a far slower thing. Now, this is interesting. There's a car going past me, so I wonder whether you can hear that as loud. So this is going forward. So we have our plate, and our plate we can actually put negative charge on our bottom plate make the top plate positive. That is, the negative charge will go into the bottom plate because it's attracted there by the positive potential in the plate above, and this creates a build-up of current. So the positive plate has too few electrons. Now the situation is that the electrons, so if you remove an electron from an atom, that's a big deal. And the case of drawing out electrons from a metal is a major big crystal of this is a regular array of nuclei, and it's possible that you can actually draw electrons out of a metal crystal. It's conduction. They can be charged. And one of the things that we're going to talk about is that, in a good conductor, there is no electric field. We'll have to discuss that a little bit later. But in this talk, as I'm entering the national park, now this is pretty heavy. I'm having to hold the shotgun microphone so I can speak, and it's vibrating around. But knowing the size of the emission cone of the microphone, I think it should be good enough. And I'll probably have a listen to this on the way back. But I have to hold up my pants. One is I've lost weight, and I'm carrying this big long cable here. Yeah, so I'm just checking that. The shotgun microphone, it's got a battery in it, so you have to remember to have the battery on, and it's just an insane bit of extra palaver. I don't know whether I'll put in a battery monitor in there so I can see how much is left in the battery, because there'd be nothing worse to be talking for an hour or so and the battery go down, or whether I should have rechargeable batteries in. Okay, so I don't know if you can imagine these two plates, electrons on one side being attracted, being pulled into one plate by the lack of electrons in the top. And this has actually been a little bit of a reverse battery, and you can use this to store energy. And so this is essentially what a capacitor does. It stores energy, but it also is highly conductive. It's obviously an insulator for DC and a conductor for AC. So essentially, if I have an AC signal and DC current with an AC signal on top of it, I can sort of short out the AC signal with the capacitor. So we often use capacitors to shape current coming in, and we use capacitors to store energy when we're starting up fluorescent light bulbs or motors, which you need a big sort of starting kick to get them moving. You start a capacitor. So we've got this thing. Now, if you were wanting to build a capacitor, what you could do is that you could get a large sheet of aluminium foil, a large sheet of greaseproof paper, and then a large piece of aluminium foil on top of it. That would produce a reasonably good capacitor. If it's a fairly large size, I don't know how you'd calculate it, but you'd put that as sort of several nanofarads. So it's be remarkable how they can actually build quite good capacitors and shrink them down. So they build the bigger capacitors by having a smaller distance. Now I'm just going to that's one way we can talk. I'll talk through how you can build a capacitor and measure it and all that type of stuff. But one of the things I want to talk about is another sense of how you could build a capacitor. You could have a wire to two sort of shallow saucepans, pancake saucepans. So there's a pancake saucepan which is only about it's flat about 30 centimeters across, and the rim is 1 centimeter high at the most. And so you can imagine you can connect your 1 volt battery to the two saucepans and have them separated by, say, some noodles, some of those I suppose spaghetti to start with. You can just put in some dry spaghetti that doesn't conduct too much, and you could put a voltmeter in, and the voltmeter would measure 1.5 volts on your little battery which you attach to it, and then you remove your battery and it will measure it will also measure 1.5 volts out of your capacitor that you've built. So if you have a battery, now the thing is that your depends on what your voltmeter is like. If it's a really good digital voltmeter, it will use current amplification circuits and not draw a big current. But if you've just got your own little school grade a voltmeter which uses a resistor which is several ohms, so many ohms, will have a small current, and that current will discharge, particularly if you've made such a crazily bad capacitor out of spaghetti and two saucepans. But we're going to do that anyway, and outside here. So we've built this anyway, and what will happen is that I will build a capacitor, and I will charge it up such it's negative and positive, and it will take a tiny amount of charge. All right, now I just want to say what the voltage means. 1 volt means it takes 1 joule to move 1 coulomb of charge. So a coulomb is a pretty just mind-bogglingly big amount of charge. For me, it's so an amp is a coulomb per second to go across it, but nonetheless, it is, in terms of the number of electrons, a coulomb is a huge number of electrons. But if I have to have that as a basket, so like if I imagine I buy a kilo of flour, the individual flour particles, you can imagine it's electrons, and it's a coulomb is like a bag of flour. It's just a quantity of electrons, and you can think of a cost of a bag of flour, or you can think of the energy to lift that bag of flour from the ground to the top of your table. And 1 volt means that there's 1 joule of energy necessary. So a volt is measured between 2 points. So voltage, like the energy difference of a mass, is measured between 2 points. So similarly, a boulder, a big, huge circular boulder, is a lot more scary if it's on top of a hill. It's got a lot of energy available to it, and you say, well, by the time it rolls down the bottom of the hill, it's just going to kill a lot of us. Well, similar to your charge, if you put the charge, you put the electrons next to each other, and that blob of repelling electrons will tend to push away and kill you just as much. It's boulder comes crashing down a cliff and kills you with a million joules of energy, like a big pop, a million volts, 1 coulomb, 1 amp at a million volts is enough to absolutely fry you. It's a sort of the same thing. Now, this is just the small side. The Americans and everywhere else around the world, they're building, they've just had enough, and they're building DC million volt cables, which provide for just an amp. So if your hairdryer is, you know, drawing an amp at 240 volts, at 240 million volts, is enough energy for a million hair dryers, and so that's equivalent. You can basically have your hairdryer cable, you know, able to take a million volts. The actual insulation has to be bigger, but the wire doesn't have to be, but the thickness of the wire is by the current, and you can actually have that wire carry a million volts, and it's DC or direct current is the way to go. And I'm about to go down the hill here, even with this shotgun microphone. I'm just going to absolutely, you're going to hear me absolutely heaving as I come out of the Glenbrook Gorge. I'll go down to the bottom of the gorge. Don't know why, it's insane. I've got to really push it here. Okay, so we're back again. We've got our 1 volt battery. We hook it up between the top and bottom plates of our saucepans, two very thin saucepans, and they're held together, held apart by spaghetti, a single layer of spaghetti, and it will measure 1 volt, 1.5 volts per coulomb. That's what it means. Volts is 1.5 joules of energy per coulomb. So if there's a, you know, there'll be no current there whatsoever, What will happen is that your spaghetti, as you attach the battery to it, it will move the charges around, and your spaghetti will be ever so slightly crushed. Now you say, "Oh, that's I don't believe that." Well, in fact, if you've ever, I've lived the dream of capacitors, because capacitors are what you need to make a flash gun, and the capacitors are what you need to make eczema lasers, you know, to dump the energy in quickly, quickly and lightly, and they make a puck, because they're suddenly compressing and then they're not, and they will actually move apart. And you can actually, if you've built a powerful enough amplifier and there's enough current going through it, you can actually hear the music coming out of the capacitors. You know, you just have to really listen to it, but you can hear a sort of a buzz, and you can hear the force, and of course you can hear the buzz of power lines. It's a very, very similar type of thing. Now, what's going to happen here is I'm going to ask you a question. If I then lift the plates apart, so it's two spaghetti widths apart, what will be the voltage on my voltmeter, and what will the voltage read? And I'll let you do some thinking music for a while. Will it be less, or will it be more? Now let's think about it. They're attracting each other, and you're putting in effort with your arms and muscles to lift it, yank it away, and indeed the charges are the same, but they're now the electric field is the same in between those two plates. And we'll have to discuss how that is so. The field is the same between those two plates, and therefore you're putting the work in. Therefore, that 1.5 volt will go to 3 volts, and then if you triple the distance, it'll go to 4.5, and 4 times the distance, it'll go to 6. But as it goes further and further away, the plates can be approximated to points, and eventually it goes to the inverse square law as you go away. But initially, as you pull it away, it's a linear increase in voltage as you go away. And this is one of these things you can actually pull. You can basically, this is fantastic. I can actually therefore measure the distance my voltmeter, and indeed this is a capacitive distance sensor. And so instead of using a ruler, you can use your voltmeter, and indeed to measure very, very tiny distances, you could use a capacitive sensor. And now I was thinking earlier on, when I was going to build what I believed to be an incredibly difficult experiment, I was wanting to measure a very, very tiny movement over a very short fraction of time, and I thought, the only way to do that is with the capacitive distance measure. Now, the beauty of a capacitive distance measure is that you've got your entire saucepan, you've got a huge area, so that's rather than when you're a ruler, you're actually measuring thousands of rulers, so it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Now, similarly, what can happen is that I can I can have a plate, and I can connect your hand, I can connect you, because you're a pretty slimy, wet thing. So if I hook you up, you're basically a conductor, okay? And if I put your hand over a plate, I can change the capacitance. So by you can change the capacitance something by actually your distance. So capacitance is the amount of charge holding capacity per volt. And there, so what? So as I pull the plates further apart, say if I pulled it four further apart, it's telling me that I need 4.5 volts to put the same charge there. So if I triple the distance, that's 1.5, 3, 4.5. I actually need more voltage to put the charge on there for. So as I've pulled it apart, I've actually reduced the capacitance. So as you push things together, you increase the capacitance. And this is, what can I say? Another beautiful, beautiful thing. So one thing is I can measure something by voltage, or if I have a circuit which operates, I can measure capacitance. Both these things, both your voltage, sheer voltage, can be used as a capacitance, as a measurement. Say if I put the volts on there, I can measure it, or as a distance measure, or I can actually measure the capacitance. If I measure the capacitance, I have a circuit which measures the capacitance. It will be sensitive to the distance, so your hand will be at distance. And this, my friend, is a theremin. This is where you have a wire, and it's measuring the capacitance of your hand to the wire. And so as you increase the capacitance, it changes the tone. And so there's a certain amount of points, so it changes the tone and the sound. And you basically, you can actually adjust it. And of course, this is a simple thing, but people, you know, actually make it up to a bit of a theatre here. Now, it's been raining like hell here, so I'm just walking down here into the gorge, and of course it's been raining like anything. And one of the things here in the Blue Mountains is that it's all like, we're the last of the sort of pretty much the last people in Australia to get broadband, optical fibre. And the reason is the soil is very thin up here, and the soil is very thin, therefore the water doesn't hang around it. And so you have a rain, it's been raining today, and I can hear the creek rave. And they've had this big, you know, head scratching, you know, it's going to cost a lot to actually put optical fibre for us up here, because we've got to get actual rock borers to bore tubes through the ground. How can that be? And of course, over the years, people have come up with better technology, and so they just have these trucks with rock borers here, sort of linear rock borers, and there's no mess. What happens is you basically get rock sludge into this tanker, and there it happens, we're going to have optical fibre here. But it also means that there's quite a creek flowing. I'll be able to give you a soundscape for it here. But it also means, because it's overcast, the heat now, and it's, I suppose it's going to get wet. It's moist here. So if it dries out, there's no moisture in the air to condense and heat the place up. There is moisture in the air, so it's actually quite pleasant. I used to freeze my socks off, as we say here. It's actually quite pleasant here. I'll give you that. So you've got the idea of a capacitor and the general features of it. So the larger your surface area of your plates, so if you have a small fry pan or a large fry pan, or if you want to double the capacitance, you use two sets of fry pans. And then if you want to increase the charge carrying capacity, I want to carry 1.5 volts, but I want to get a lot of things, you get thinner noodles. You might even get, say, flour and just spring it in there so that the two plates, or you may have a non-stick surface which doesn't conduct, or you may have anodized stuff, aluminium. It does conduct, unfortunately. High enough voltage anodized surfaces conduct, and your aluminium it just conducts like anything. So your aluminium foil, just to tell you the shiny side, so you've got the shiny side and your matte side. The matte side is oxidized, but your shiny side has got a thin film of plastic on it. And so this is sort of one of the sadder things with aluminium. Even your Coke can has plastic in it, and it's actually quite a thick thing. Oh shit, there's a car coming. Okay, I'm going to get it come off here. Oh shit, there's two cars coming. What are they doing? I'll point the microphone at it. It stinks as well, and that they're going like all hell up to the top of this national park, which is closed. So I've just got to watch it, because they'll kill me the other way, coming the other way. So I hope with that sound we'll pick that up. So your capacitors there is a storage unit, and you've got the idea that current goes on it, and you've got your basic use of your capacitance as a distance measure, and you've got the understanding that a capacitor builds up charges with DC electricity. With AC electricity, it's charging, discharging, and basically it can if you put the charge forward and take it away, put it forward and take it away, you can basically behave as if there's no break in the wire whatsoever. Now we're up here for the creek, and again with my shotgun microphone I'm going to actually point it at the creek so you can hear it. Up in the sky there. Now I've got to turn around and go up this bloody slope. No, so it's a what? Or it's not. It's 75 meters easily. It's close to 100 meters climb up here, and possibly probably less than a kilometer. But it's just as breaking to get up here. So that my friend is the capacitor, and I hope you've had a feeling of it, and the feeling of what voltage is and stuff like that. And perhaps the greatest thing you've learnt is that a battery operates, a chemical battery operates by routing. Electrons can't go through certain things. They can't go through glass or liquids, but ions can go through liquids. And so you have an ion path one way, and electrons go up the other way, and the voltage, the electric field, is the electric field of your proton going in. So we'll just have a stop there, and I'll start my next episode as I'm coming up the slope.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.